Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 235 and part one of my conversation with Adams State University in Colorado percussion professor Melinda Leosi. We'll get to her shortly. It's a very exciting week here in Columbia. Not only is it currently spring break, which is always welcome, but the day I'm recording this, my wife and I were able to, surprisingly, get our first doses of the Pfizer COVID vaccine. We are incredibly grateful and happy to get to this part and excited to hopefully get the second dose in a few weeks. I remain cautiously optimistic that we will be able to get past this pandemic sooner rather than later, but we will continue to abide by the usual safety protocols until they can be relaxed. After that bit of good news, let's get to some more with today's guest, Melinda Leosi. Melinda is one of a number of guests I've had in the past where we've somehow not met until this interview, but we know a lot of people in common. The list was pretty extensive. In any case, when that happens, it sort of feels like you're meeting an old friend, even though, again, we have never met before this interview. But I'm glad Melinda was up for it. Melinda's been active in both the percussion and the band world for a number of years. She just took over at Adams State this year from previous podcast guest James Doyle, who has moved on to another position in the state of Washington. She previously taught for 3 years at Graceland University in Iowa, where she was the percussion director, band director, and department chair. And theory chair? I think she might have coached a football team. I don't know. She did a lot there, is what I'm saying. She's also continuing to work towards finishing her doctorate very soon in percussion performance from Indiana University. So she's busy. You get it. Okay, great. In any case, we cover all of this and plenty more in our extended interview, which will, once again, be split up into two parts. In part one, we'll get to her college employment, her beginnings in music, and her figure skating career. In part two, we'll get to the rest. So here we go. We recorded this interview over Zoom on March 1st, 2021, and it begins right now. Leosi? Is that how you pronounce it? Leosi. Yeah. What's the origin of the name?
The origin is Italian, If we were really being traditional about that, then it would probably be something like Leoce.
Yeah.
But it's Italian, and that's just how my family has said it for as long as I've been around.
Do you know what part of Italy?
Yeah, actually I do. It's from a small town called Bari, B-A-R-I, I think.
Okay. Do you know where?
Apparently they had something to do with the Leosi family, I guess, had something to do with like making the paper that wraps the grapes for wine.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if this is accurate. I'm not like, I don't do like ancestry.com or any, I mean, we really know very little, I think, as a family, but that's what I've heard from my dad. And that's where the Italian side, my dad's side is the Italian side. So, okay. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, great. Well, Leosi. Give me a summation of your percussion activities as they are right now.
So I am the visiting assistant professor of percussion and music business at Adams State University in Alamosa, Colorado. So I teach applied lessons. I teach percussion ensemble. I teach some world music ensembles that we have here, a Brazilian ensemble, sort of a jazz band with lots of fusion in it as well. And then I teach some music business courses. I teach music appreciation. That's something that's going this semester as well. And aside from that, I'm an auxiliary percussionist with Des Moines Symphony. I have been doing that for the last, I want to say, 3 to 4 years. I think I started that in 2017. Of course, this season has been very limited in the percussion side of things. And I live in Colorado now, so I hope to play with them. I'm still actively on their list, but I know that they had very few concerts with percussion this year. Same thing with WGI and marching band groups. Those are sort of on hold. I teach a little bit here and there, either virtually or recently I was working with Crossroads Percussion based in Des Moines. That's an activity that I love. I'm sure we'll talk about some marching things, but at the moment, there's just really not a safe way to do that. I do have a couple things scheduled here soon in the Colorado Springs area, so that should be good as people are starting to get vaccinated and starting to sort of go in person again and things like that. I spend a good amount of my free time writing my dissertation. So I'm finishing my dissertation up at the at Indiana University in Bloomington. And my dissertation is a percussion methods textbook. So I've got about 115 pages written of that. Of course, it's a very long topic and all-encompassing, and so I'm sure it'll be closer to 200 by the time I put in pictures and all that stuff. But I do consider that one of my activities, writing and writing exercises and, my students being guinea pigs for the exercises that I write for the book and that kind of thing. We do that as well. So it's a little sum up of what I've been doing lately.
That's it? No. And then on Tuesday.
Yeah. Having a full-time job and also finishing up grad school is not for everybody, but it is the way that it happened for me, and it is the scenic route, as I like to say. So it takes a little bit longer, but as long as I'm making some forward progress, I feel decent about that. So I finished up my qualifying exams in July of 2019, and now working on the dissertation. I have recital to give. And so, yeah, there's a couple more things that I have to check off. And as long as I'm making a little bit of forward progress, that's a victory in my book.
It was this year, right, that you started working at Adams State?
Yes.
So how did that come about?
Yeah, sure. So I started here in the fall, in the middle of a global pandemic. So the job was previously James Doyle, who's awesome. I think I saw him on your list of guests on the podcast. Super, super nice guy. And, someone who has helped me a lot with the transition for sure. He's always, cell phone call away or a text, like, hey, where's this? Or do you own one of these? Or do we own one of these? Right. So he's been super helpful. I know him and his wife went to pursue like some administrative opportunities up at the University of Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest. It wasn't a job that they advertised. You didn't see it on higheredjobs.com. I think James.
When did you first become aware of it?
I first became aware of it in, I would say, the spring of 2020. And at that time, I was working at Graceland University in Iowa. I know a couple of my friends contacted me and said, hey, we're friends with James Doyle. We saw through various things, Twitter, Facebook, social media, et cetera, that he's moving up to the Pacific Northwest. And we're not sure what's going to happen with that job, but we feel like you'd be interested. I think they knew about some of the Brazilian ensemble work that James had done with the studio here, and that there's a steel pan program here as well. And those are two things that I really love doing, that I have some experience in at my old job in Iowa as well. And so they thought like, hey, if you're looking around. So then I started to look into the program. On a side note, I'm a skier. I really enjoyed my time in Iowa, but I knew that I didn't necessarily want to settle down in Iowa forever. And Colorado, just as far as like the recreational activity, the skiing, the hiking, that's sort of up my alley. And so I was automatically interested when I saw jobs open up in this area.
And which makes sense. You know, that makes sense. The skiing growing up in Atlanta. Wait, hold on. Anyway.
Yeah. So actually, you're going to be even more surprised because I actually grew up in Florida.
Oh, all right. Yes, of course. The mountainous state of Florida. Yes.
Well, we have a lot of landfills that are considered mountains down there. So right. That's the tallest you know, vertical height you're going to get in Florida. Yeah. Actually, I grew up as an ice skater. I don't know how that happened. I guess it was like my parents were trying to find what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And I was a little kid and I went through soccer, t-ball, dance, this, that. And when they put me in ice skating lessons, that's what I ended up liking. So I was always doing winter sports, even living in South Florida, which is always 80, including on Christmas Day.
Right.
And so I don't know. Skiing just came after that. I went with some friends and I got hooked like right away. So there's a small ski area called Paoli Peaks, and it's about an hour south of Bloomington, Indiana. And for years, while I was getting my my coursework done at Indiana, I would just go down skiing every few weeks. And it wasn't anything big. There was like 8 total trails, but I could keep skiing. Yeah. And now I kind of live in like the, you know, hub of ski resort. So it's really cool.
Oh, nice. So
I think we were actually talking about how this job came out, but we went off on a tangent. And that's
You fast forwarded like 45 minutes later into the questions, which is fine.
So anyway, some friends had sort of put it on my radar, but at that point they weren't sure if they had an adjunct lined up or if they were not going to open it for a year, maybe look around. A friend of mine in Durango, John O'Neill, who I think was also a guest
on the podcast, Fort Collins?
Fort Lewis.
Yeah.
Fort Lewis. John actually called me then with actual information about the job. You know, he was friends with James Doyle and said, hey, they're not going to really search this, but they are opening it up. And, they kind of asked around and so I think there was sort of a, small pool of applicants that, that ended up doing interviews and it ended up being a good fit, and that's kind of how it all happened.
Got it. So what is it like to both move and start a new job in a global pandemic?
Well, you know, I've talked to people about this before. When I got to my job in Iowa, Graceland University, it was like I could hit the ground running. First couple months, they put out an audition for Des Moines Symphony for percussion subs. Went, auditioned there, got that, was able to start playing with them right away. Within another few months, my friends from WGI kind of contacted me, and then I started working with Crossroads Percussion. So I could kind of network really quickly in the state of Iowa. And I will say that it is a lot more difficult here. But there's been some really great people that have helped me get started. John O'Neill definitely being one of them. James Doyle, who contacts me, and lets me know about different gigs, or, hey, you should maybe call this person. And a couple other people in the Colorado PAS circle, Kevin Lehman, who I did a podcast with a few weeks ago, who kind of was like, hey, listen, I know you moved in the middle of a pandemic. Let me help you, kind of network around. So that's awesome. And I think that is just super gracious of them and super helpful. But I guess the way I would describe moving in a global pandemic and trying to start a new job and everything is everything takes about twice as long as it would in normal times.
Right.
Whether that is getting to know your colleagues, for the most part, we have a mix. We are teaching in person at Adams State with masks and distancing, but not all of our professors are on campus. Some of them are teaching remote because they're immune compromised, et cetera. So I don't think I met the entire faculty for 2 or 3 weeks actually in person when I first got here. Kind of getting to know the students, lessons are really different. Some of our studio classes are virtual. We were in person most of the year, but then we got pulled to go virtual about the last week and a half of school. So you just kind of have less FaceTime with everybody.
Yeah.
And so I think things just take a little bit longer. You have to be a little bit more creative about how to do them, but you also kind of see how many people are willing to help as well. And that's been really nice.
Now, is some of the challenge when you got to, you know, make these connections, just the fact that Colorado is so spread out?
Yeah. And you know, I'm sort of used to that because, when I was working in Iowa, at Graceland, it's in a very small town called Lamoni, and Lamoni is about 35 miles from the nearest Walmart and McDonald's and about 70 miles from the nearest Target. So I was pretty isolated in Lamoni. Then moving here, I was sort of used to that, but this is sort of a different kind of remoteness. Now the town of Alamosa actually is really cool. I love it. It's bigger. It's got more variety, more restaurants, some breweries, some really fun things to do. And of course the sand dunes are like 30 minutes away. Closest ski resort is about an hour and 15 minutes. I was actually there yesterday. So, and I wasn't playing hooky. We actually had a day off yesterday. I promise. We are about 4 hours from Denver. 2 hours from Colorado Springs or so, and that's where kind of the nearest regional airport is. So I would say it's a nicer environment. I really like the town, colleagues, friends, things to do, but it's farther away from things, and it is harder to get to those things because you have to cross mountains to get there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when John, when I talked to him, he told me about how the white knuckling first trip, I think, with the truck to get to where he was. He was like, oh my goodness, what have I agreed to?
Oh yeah. That, you know, that pass that is really close to him, mm-hmm. is called Wolf Creek Pass. And if anybody's familiar with Colorado, it's not just one of these like, oh, how nice, a little scenic mountain pass. It's like, oh my gosh, I have to go 15 miles an hour or less. Like, it better not snow. The wind better not hit the, you know, car and just like the wrong way. I mean, it takes a lot of getting used to. But I, like I said, there's so many awesome activities to do in Colorado. For me, the trade-off is totally worth it. You know, to be a little farther from everything, but to have kind of more in the town that you live in, and then to be able to be in some of the most beautiful parts of the country within an hour is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Possible mountain death. And breweries, microbreweries. Okay. Yeah, I see. Yeah. That
makes sense. If I don't fall off the mountain, I'll get to the ski resort.
Yes, there you go. Where I could break my leg, but you know.
Yeah.
So in terms of the teaching, how much, when you get there, what is the expectation? Again, pandemic, having to do with like size of the studio, your own breakdown of what you had to teach, what was the setup, and then did it actually become that, or did it even change once you got here?
You know, when I got here, I immediately wanted to get into recruiting because that's important anywhere that you work in the country right now, especially for music programs, especially for liberal arts schools. You know, we have a slightly smaller enrollment, you know, we're under 3,000 students. I had come from a place that was under 1,000 students. So I kind of knew, you know, recruiting is really important. And so, you know, my colleagues are great here. And they came up with some virtual opportunities. So I'd say an average of once every 2 weeks or so, we go in and virtually speak to high schools and middle schools in the area, whether it's New Mexico. Actually, Adams State offers really close to in-state tuition for students in New Mexico because we're pretty close to the border and we have a really good relationship with those students. We're a Hispanic-serving institution as well. So a lot of the students with Hispanic background there in New Mexico, you know, come here and have a really good experience. And then also just in the surrounding areas of Colorado, Colorado Springs, you know, a couple cities that are west of Colorado, a couple suburbs of Denver. and things like that. So we do get in and do virtual recruiting opportunities. And we have some ways to try and make that interesting. We've got some virtual slideshows we've made. We used to do a in-person music student for a day opportunity. So we've now switched that to a virtual music student for a day opportunity where students can pop into classes and things like that. And then in addition to that, I wanted to do some specific percussion recruiting. So I've got a couple virtual presentations on steel pan, snare drum, things like that, that I've done with some schools around the country. And then namely just kind of offered it for free for schools in Colorado. And I did have a couple people call me up and say, hey, let's do it. You know, so I've done some steel pan history clinics with, you know, with high school groups. And then as far as, you know, rehearsal structure and all that, I think it changed quite a bit. When I first got there, I thought for sure we are going remote. You know, we might start in person, we'll be remote within 2 weeks. And then 2 weeks went by and we weren't yet. And two more weeks went by and we weren't, and the cases were still really low. We're sort of in an isolated part of Colorado in a really big valley. And I think there were a total of 3 cases in the entire valley for a while in the summer. So it was really safe to continue on in person. But I think I had planned a lot for remote teaching because I really thought that we would go remote. I thought it was going to be inevitable. So I had to kind of be creative, and some of my colleagues and I got together and we decided to plan some outdoor concerts. And that's something that we did in the fall. I collaborated with the choir professor here. She's on sabbatical currently, but she's great, Dr. Beth Robison. And we did a Black Lives Matter concert that was a combined percussion and choir concert. And it was awesome. We had a lot of the campus community come out for it. The weather held. We thought it was going to be really cold, but it actually kind of was warm like that day. And it was a really, really good experience. And then a couple days after that, we did a percussion ensemble concert outside, and everyone kind of rallied together, got there, helped set up mics, you know, all that kind of thing. So yeah, I think there was definitely a lot of, well, that was plan A, that didn't work. Okay, plan B. All right, that's not going to work anymore either. Okay, plan C and a half. and we made it happen, and the students were all really patient too about all the stuff, and we got some good musical experiences even though we had to really rethink a few things.
The classes that you're teaching in music business and music preach, were those expected things that you were going to be doing, or were they, or was that kind of a function of your current teaching load?
I kind of took over the classes that James Doyle had been teaching, and he was, you know, really one of the main people that was heading the music business department here. So he taught a careers in music business class, and then also later a topics in music business class. So I knew that I would be taking those over. Music appreciation, although I know James did teach that, I wasn't 100% sure about that one. That one is kind of one that shifts around the department a bit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm just a weirdo. I love teaching music appreciation.
Oh yeah. Me yeah, too.
I'm teaching it right now and having like a total blast with my students. On Friday, I had them all learn marching technique. So we're all like, you know, roll stepping across the room and everything. And then, you know, today we were listening to The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. And, you know, so I mean, I really enjoy teaching classes that have kind of a mix of majors and non-majors. And so that one was sort of a surprise, but the chair approached me in the fall and said, hey, you know, you could do this. Would you be interested? And I was like, oh, definitely. And so I think she kind of shifted some things around, and that one was like a happy surprise.
Going back to Graceland, is that where you were?
Yes.
So how long had you been there?
So I taught at Graceland for 3 years, 2017 to 2020.
Well, how did you end up getting that job?
So I had finished my coursework at Indiana. Okay. And, I, like any struggling grad student, really, you know, really wanted to start having a paycheck. And again, I know some people that did it a different way. For me, I worked my way through grad school. I was a waitress. I worked at Panera Bread. I worked at Firehouse Subs. I had so many jobs kind of putting myself through school, of course, with the assistance of loans and my parents and everything. But when I finished my coursework at Indiana, I just knew for my quality of life, I have to get a job. And I would really like it to be in my field. So I kind of just started applying. Anything that was open, no matter where it was, any state. I'm pretty sure I've applied at like 35 states in the continental US. I mean, just so many applications. And I ended up, you know, getting a few interviews, a few phone interviews, and then kind of getting to a finalist round and, you know, a few of those. And then again, Graceland just ended up being a good fit. And so I got that in the fall of 2017. And at Graceland, I was the instructor of percussion and the director of athletic bands. So I, was also doing this, you know, band directing part of it as well, which, you know, I have a lot of marching and drum corps experience and teaching, you know, WGI and DCI and all that stuff. So that was really fun. But I knew that I wanted to have something that was a little more full-time percussion and not as much split between the athletic bands. Now I love working with drumline, but this was the full shebang. So I was, you know, directing the winds as well. And for me, I mean, I loved it and I had really good experiences there with the kids that were in marching band. Like they worked their butts off and they were great. But I did know that I wanted to, have a little more of a full-time percussion job. And that's at that point, I kind of started looking around, and seeing what else was available.
All right. So you said you've worked with DCI and WGI, but were those in just drumline situations or did you actually have like wind, experience on those specific?
My undergrad, was a bachelor's in music education. Yep. So I did have some, preparation for that there. But my experience was really more on the drumline side of things. Now I love arranging. So I knew that I could arrange for the group really successfully. And I knew that that was something that I would be interested in doing. And I had arranged for groups of various instrumentation before, including winds and all that. Once I kind of started to experience, okay, you know, band directing, I kind of knew that I wanted to go more just on the drumline side. And actually, my colleague and I kind of had talked about switching roles. The director of bands at Graceland now kind of took over the band director position, and I took over like an assistant band director drumline role, and that was somewhere where I was more comfortable. But again, you know, when I saw that application and saw okay, director of bands, I called Adam Groh, who had been the professor at Graceland prior to me. And it's another person that I knew from Florida State. He's great. He works at Western Carolina University and fantastic player, great person. So I called Adam and I was like, listen, I'm really nervous about this band director side. You know, the percussion side looks awesome, but can you give me any insight into the band director since you have the position? And he said, well, there's actually more than meets the eye with this situation. So he said, we don't actually have a marching band yet here. We are trying to start one. And the uniforms are purchased. We don't have an active marching band. So you would be really starting it, getting it off the ground. And when I heard that, I kind of consulted with some of my other colleagues and friends and mentors in the past who I had worked with in, you know, marching in the marching arts. And they said, yeah, that sounds like something you could do. They were like, you know, you'd be great getting something off the ground like that. If it gets to the point where it's 150 people and all that, then maybe you could rethink it at that point. But they kind of gave me some confidence like, yeah, this sounds like a situation where you could, you know, do great. So, and you know, I'm really proud of what we did there with the marching band. Like I said, we had under 1,000 people enrolled in the entire school. We had a music department that was under 20. And my marching band got up to, I want to say about 21 or 22 people, which was a really large chunk of campus. If you look historically at the fact that marching bands are between 0 and 1% of the campus as a whole. And like I said, I mean, it's really hard when you have one tuba, for example. Right. If that one tuba is gone at a show, you lose all of your bass voice. But the kids just really cared about what we were doing. Graceland had had a marching band in the past. They felt really passionate about trying to get it off the ground again. And, you know, some of the alumni felt really passionate about it. And so they really would be there as much as possible. They would put in extra rehearsals. And I think we went from 0 to 13 to 21. And so we were making some progress. And then I know that it's in good hands now with the director of bands there now. Although I think they've gone more of like almost like a pep band route at this point.
Did they have a football team?
Yes.
Was like NAIA or something like that? Do you want Division III?
Heart of America Conference?
No, well, I meant the division level.
Oh, see, this is showing my sports knowledge. I was telling my music appreciation students the other day, I go to football games for the marching band.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I actually, it might be NAIA. I think that sounds.
I mean, a school that size that's private, it would seems likely.
Yeah.
What's the history of that school?
They were founded in the late 1800s. And actually, the history is they actually started as a religious school. There's a religion called Community of Christ. And their headquarters are based in Lamoni, but also they have a large temple in Kansas City, just outside of Kansas City. And so Graceland University has two campuses, the main campus in Lamoni, and then they have a campus that does quite a bit of nursing and some other programs that's a smaller satellite campus just outside of Kansas City. And they, for a long time, were a Community of Christ, you know, school. And then they are still affiliated with the Community of Christ, but they're not a religious school. We do have, or we did have, a population of Community of Christ students, but they were, you know, welcoming of all different, you know, religious groups, et cetera. So that's where the history sort of lies, is with the Community of Christ Church. It's actually a really cool progressive church. And I really felt good that they were very progressive and welcoming to LGBTQ community, things like that, which I felt really passionate about, because I thought if I'm going to work at a school that's affiliated with a religion, I want to make sure that it's something that I, you know, stand behind, and, you know, that's something that I care about a lot. They're really progressive, really neat, neat religion that I wouldn't have really known anything about until I ended up working there. So.
All right. So we have kind of the marching band set up. What was the percussion setup there like?
Well, so Adam Groh, who was my predecessor at Graceland, he had really started the percussion major. There was not really a percussion major before that. And it kind of like delighted the community once they saw, oh, like percussion is really cool. And this concert is, it's not just drumline, but it's, you know, these other hand drums and, you know, marimbas and things like that. So the community really stood behind it. And so it was a very small program. There's only a handful of percussion majors there. I think there's about one per year, essentially. You know, there's like one freshman, one sophomore, one junior, one senior. I love my students from Graceland. I'm still in contact with them. which I'm very happy about. We have kind of a mentor-mentee relationship. I'll write letters of recommendation for them, help them with, you know, scene recital, repertoire, that kind of thing. And we made the small numbers work by incorporating some non-majors as well into the percussion ensemble. So we'd have the majors on, you know, some of the works that were a little more challenging. And then we'd have non-majors come in, or other music majors that were in different instruments or that were vocalists and they had the music reading background. And then they would end up, you know, learning a little bit of the technique and participating in percussion ensemble. Yeah, I mean, we'd have anywhere from, I think, 4 all the way to like 8 to 10 people in percussion ensemble. And when I was at Graceland, I started a steel band there, and that really increased some of the enrollment as far as people who wanted to participate in percussion ensemble and play pan. And yeah, so it was small, very close knit. All the students kind of felt like siblings in both a good and, you know, brothers and sisters sometimes fight.
Oh, yeah, right.
So, of course, we would have those times where when you're in the exact same class with the exact same people and you only have it was a 4-person faculty at Graceland. Mm. So I also taught music theory, all 4 levels of music theory while I was there. And I directed the jazz band. So, I mean, they saw a lot of me. But yeah, it was great. Really, really cool students there. And they really put everything into the percussion program. And they've had some good successes there. Actually, this semester, 3 out of 4 of the winners of their scholarship competition were percussionists. So yeah, the program was small, but mighty.
How big of a jazz band did you have?
Oh, we had anywhere from 5 to about 7 people. So sort of a jazz combo. And instrumentation could range anywhere from having 1 trumpet to having no trumpets and 2 trombones to having, you know, 1 saxophone and, you know, a pianist. It could really be anything. And, when I first got there, I co-taught the jazz band with a colleague of mine, and he really was creative.
Like this.
Right, exactly.
Open the big book.
Exactly.
There's your scores, everybody.
Right. Oh, yeah, we had to be really creative with the instrumentation and the stuff that we programmed. And, you know, I did some arranging for the group or just went through and found some interesting, like, trombone features. And, yeah, so that was interesting, too.
Did you ever play, I think the piece is called La Morga. It's an early like salsa piece that just has this bass trombone, Montuno that goes through the whole thing. It's pretty sweet.
No, you know, when we had the instrumentation with 2 trombones, cause that's a real thing. It wasn't just me making up we had 2 trombone players, 2 female trombone players, which was even cooler.
Nice.
So my, colleague at the time who I was co-teaching with, he found these arrangements by these 2 trombone players called J and K.
Okay.
And they had all these double trombone arrangements and we did like a arrangement of Georgia on My Mind and all these things. And yeah, it was awesome. And again, that was super cool to watch him kind of, you know, teach it and sort of be co-teaching with him. And then the next year I took it over, you know, and it was just me, as that person had retired at that point. But I felt like he really got me started thinking creatively and like where to find arrangements and things like that. So.
Yeah. And then your students come in wanting to play like Tower Power or Snarky Puppy. And you're like,
Yes.
Hold on a sec.
Yeah, you know, we did a listening journal. We started the day with a listening journal every day.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that Snarky Puppy would have been at least about 10 listening journals that we did.
Of course.
Yeah, they're just so awesome. And yeah, we'd spend like the first 30 minutes of class getting inspired by them.
Yeah. Nice. And then you're like B flat scale. Oh.
Oh, we actually have to play today.
Yeah, right. Why don't you sound like them? No. That's after. That's when you drive the hour and a half to a Target to, you know, pick up alcohol.
Milk.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, yeah. The trips to Target were very important.
Yeah. I had worked at, before my wife and I were married, we worked at Concord University, which is in West Virginia. And there was we had a similar situation. Well, we had a little bit more in the town, but the Target was an hour away and the Barnes and Noble was an hour away. And so we would, as you probably know where this is going, like that was a big event when we would go to the store, to those stores, or like make a day of it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, when I was living in that small town in Iowa and the pandemic hit, then it became, all right, I'm driving up to Des Moines. I'm going to, you know, whatever I was doing up there that day, a vet appointment, yeah, my dogs, something. But I'd try to pair it with, you know, okay, and I'm going to pick up to-go food from this place. And because the pandemic was hitting really hard at that time, I like didn't want to get out of my car at all. Right. So it'd be like 3 hours straight. You can't pee. So right, don't drink a lot of water. I'm just going to be in my car. Maybe I'll run in and get to-go food. But if it's curbside pickup, I'm spending the next 3 hours in my car driving, doing whatever I need to do in Des Moines, and then driving home. And inevitably, it'd be like, oh my gosh, I have to pee. Where am I going to go? Like, you know, begging the vet. So can I use your bathroom too? I have a mask. I have sanitizer. Yeah. I have Lysol spray. I'll just please let me pee.
I'll let you spray me as I walk into the vet. That's fine.
Oh yeah.
God, that's wild. Cause I don't even know that I would have thought about the challenges of just getting food in a pandemic and that.
Ew. Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, Lamoni has about 9 restaurants. Mm-hmm. It's like under 10, you know, it's very, very limited. Yeah. I became really close with the workers at Pizza Hut. I'm pretty sure while I was living in Lamoni, I accumulated like 9 million Pizza Hut points or something. I lived close enough to Pizza Hut to walk my pizza back to my house too. So, you know, there was a lot of Pizza Hut in my life at that time. And, but they also had some really cool local places. So they had a local Mexican restaurant, and when the pandemic hit, I made a point to get to go from them at least once a week. Mm-hmm. And they have killer mole.
Mm,
so if you're ever in Lamoni, Iowa, stop at La Cocina Real and get their mole because it's awesome. And it was like the little things like that. We also had a bed and breakfast just up the road, and they would do a special meal once a week, order it. And the chef would cook it, and she was awesome, great cook. And then you'd go and pick it up between 4 and 5 or whatever on a Thursday night. And so I would really try to support all the local businesses in town when I lived there, because I knew that they were really struggling, even more so than other towns are struggling, because it's such a small town and there's such a small population there. And so, yeah, definitely the little things. They have a great coffee shop there. Awesome coffee shop, sausage muffin for breakfast. Again, if you're ever in Lamoni, Iowa, try the sausage muffin at Linden Street Coffee Shop. I'm giving them a shout out.
Nice. You would walk into you were one of the few people who could walk into a Pizza Hut and they would already be like, your pizza would be half cooked basically because they saw you like walking by.
Absolutely. Yeah, they knew my order.
Yeah.
But and if we were feeling really fancy, we'd go to the Pizza Hut buffet.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Salad bar, buffet. That was like a night on the town.
Of course. Awesome. How much of, you know, getting to Adams State was a desire to, as you said, go to more of a full-time percussion position, and how much of it was, I really kind of want to live in a larger place?
I would say, honestly, it was probably about 65-35. Which one? 65 being, I really would like a full-time percussion position. Now, I mean, the job at Graceland was full-time, but it did have that large component of other things. You know, in such a small faculty, I was also an administrator there. I was the chair of the music department within the first year that I was teaching at Graceland. I was the marching band director. I was the jazz band director. I taught all four levels of music theory, which I love music theory. And it gave me so much great experience, but it was a huge load. And, you know, having the administrative stuff right off the bat was, I think, just a lot of responsibility. And I really wanted to be able to focus on building a percussion curriculum. And I was just really splitting my time a lot of ways. So I'd say, yeah, 65%. I really wanted something that if it did have an athletic band component, it was going to be drumline versus the entire athletic band. And then 35%, you know, I'm a fairly happy person. And I think drum corps really did teach me this. You can be happy wherever you are. You could be in the middle of a condemned building in Louisiana, sleeping in a sleeping bag, and you could be happy. You know, I've done a lot of traveling throughout the country and, you know, both with drum corps and just because I like road trips. And so I actually really enjoyed my time in Iowa, especially the fact that I had so many connections in Des Moines. But I really did know that I didn't want to live in Lamoni for very much longer. So I definitely wasn't, you know, I mean, I wasn't depressed. I wasn't, you know, if I had ended up staying there for a few more years, that would have been totally cool. I had enough connections in Des Moines that I felt like I had a really full, rich life. I had really good friends down there, really good colleagues. But I'm kind of a foodie. I love having a Thai restaurant in town. And here in Alamosa, we have two Thai restaurants, two Chinese, a million Mexican, you know, breweries, pubs. I mean, it's just really great to be able to get something that's not Pizza Hut. Although we do have a Pizza Hut here. And I've got to use some of the points that I accumulated while I was living in Iowa here. No, but really, it is a better quality of life. And that really does matter to me. And I think I could have toughed it out for a few more years in Iowa, but I was ready to move on and have some other things in my life that I could do that were more fulfilling as well.
You know, Melinda, Pizza Hut has plenty of different types of crusts. So I don't know what you're talking about. I feel like you're somehow you're underselling it.
I mean, the cheese lovers is a personal favorite of mine. And if you add pineapple and pepperoni to the cheese lovers, everyone do it and thank me after this. You'll never go back.
Yeah. Well, although here on a more serious point though, and I was thinking about with the, you know, your responsibilities is that, had you been noticing, or was there anything where you're like, you know, if I do this much longer, what is my percussion? Where am I going to be as a player? Where am I going to be as, you know, developed in that realm? Because yeah, if you're having the grade theory, holy cow, that's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. So, you know, the way the credits broke down at that school, we only had one section of each theory course. Okay. So that was about 3 credits per semester. Now, you know, if I had been working somewhere with a slightly bigger music program where there was, you know, 2 sections of theory 1 and 2 sections of theory 3 all running concurrently, then it really would have been taking up all of my time. But I mean, it was somewhat manageable in that I definitely still had time to practice and to play. And also I had a small percussion ensemble, so I played in almost every one of our pieces. Mm. So I was definitely playing, but I did feel, I guess, a slight struggle with the administrator role.
You get the job and you're thrusted, like, or you knew like this was going to be part of the deal?
No, I got the job and I had no idea that it would include a chair role. I guess maybe I should have been slightly aware because Adam Groh had been the chair before he left. And, you know, in a 4-person faculty, it's going to rotate. Right. It's going to get to you quick, right? Quicker than it would in a, you know, huge faculty. At Indiana University, there's 4 percussion professors alone.
Right. There's like, was it like 100? It's like 100 plus faculty, right? Like 180 or something like that.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, there's more piano faculty than the entire faculty times like 3 at somewhere like Graceland or Adams. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had, one of our good friends, do you know, Julia Bentley?
She's
a voice teacher at, Indiana. But she taught at Mizzou. I think she's been in Indiana she's been in Indiana for like 3 years now or something. So it's like after you were a full-time, student there, but I didn't know how big their department was. And she was saying like, yeah, I don't even know if I've met all the voice faculty. I mean, cause apparently it's like in the teens.
Oh, it is. Oh yeah. I mean, there are so many. And the only ones I knew, well, I happened to live with 4 vocalists at one point when I was in Bloomington in a big townhouse. So I only knew them describing their teachers or talking about their lessons and saying, you know, a certain last name. But there were voice professors that I never met. I mean, there were multiple professors I never met and lots of students that, you know, the percussion building is kind of separated at Indiana. We're in the East Studio building, which is like one of the newest buildings on campus. It's super nice. And we're kind of in the basement. Actually, it's not kind of in the basement. We are in the basement, but it's got windows and stuff. So you don't really feel like cooped up. It's a beautiful, beautiful space. But man, you spend all day in that basement. And then there's like 5 other music buildings on campus alone. And it's across the street. So you're not going to, sometimes you just go into the basement and then you go home. So absolutely. There's people that I don't know. Now I would definitely know all the percussion majors when I was there. We spent enough time together. Certainly not all the vocal professors or the jazz professors or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild.
So yeah, I guess that, that administrative role came to me because it just happened to be the year that I was hired there. My colleague, Erin Bodner, hired me. She's awesome. She's the band director now down at University of North Florida, and she's doing incredible things there. And she hired me, and then she shortly after that got the offer at UNF and decided to go. Well, she had been chair. And when she decided to leave, we also needed a new band director. So even though I had just finished my first year teaching, the band director was going to be brand new. And there were, you know, a couple other reasons that Erin kind of said, hey, I'll train you to do chair if you're interested. And I said, like, no, I would rather not. You know, I kind of want to focus on percussion curriculum and just teaching and getting a few full-time years under my belt first. And she said, no, you're going to be fine. You got it, you know? So she just kind of started training me before she left. And then, I started that fall. So I got hired in fall of 2017. And then I was, chair of the music department by fall of 2018.
You know, what's funny is that there are so many percussionists, I think we're kind of perfectly set up to be chairs or administrators for all the stuff we have to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's one story that I tell people about when I was chair, you know, cause there was definitely some things that I enjoyed about it. I got a call one time. They left a message on my answering machine, and it was someone from a small town in Iowa that was about 3 or 4 hours away, and they said they needed a bagpipe player for a funeral. And for some reason, they decided to call Graceland University, the chair of the department, to ask about a bagpipe player. And so I got that message. And within an hour, I called back with two names. And, you know, so that was kind of the story of chair. Like, you need a bagpipe player? I'll get you a bagpipe player. You'll have it within the hour. So there were some things I really enjoyed. Like, you know, I'm pretty good at follow-up. I actually liked kind of keeping in contact with everyone through emails. I headed a search at that time too, and I really enjoyed that, like looking at all the candidates and being really organized about their materials. And then there were some other things that I think that, you know, I still just needed more time to be able to focus on percussion. You know, some administrative things you have to do with writing reports and that kind of stuff where you're like, oof, I really need to grade that theory test or I really need to plan the percussion ensemble schedule or, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, it was definitely a good experience. I'm glad that I have the administrator experience. I would probably, you know, want to wait at least a good few years before I pursued something like that, you know, here at Adams or wherever I might end up.
Yeah. I mean, you have all the higher up meetings you have, it's like the other level of meetings because you're a representative of a certain area. So you have to, you know,
yeah.
I will say that you disappointed me a little bit with the bagpipe story. Cause I was expecting you to say, well, I play bagpipes and then can I get there in 3 hours? Like, you know, like I went somewhere else where with the, as you had started talking. So.
No, bagpipes is not, one of my specialties. I did do, a world music certificate at Florida State University. And I was in the Irish ensemble while I was there. But you know, of course bagpipes are Scottish. You know, right. That's the closest I can get. I'm sorry to disappoint. If you need some power on, I can hack it out.
There it is. So Melinda, you said, well, you grew up in both Florida and Georgia. Is that right?
Yeah. So I was in Georgia until about fourth grade, but I spent so many years in Florida, you know, from fourth grade all the way up through my master's degree at Florida State. And so I really kind of consider myself a Floridian at this point.
Got it. Did you have any family members in the arts?
My family is extremely musical, but I wouldn't say that any of them went into the arts as a full-time career. So my mom is a great pianist, and a really, has a great voice, and she can, I mean, I just remember when I was growing up, my mom would be singing harmonies in the car. And as a kid, I'd be like, how does she do that? How does she just find the harmony and sing the right thing? Just the first time she's hearing a song. Right. And my dad is actually a drummer. He grew up as a drum set player in, you know, a lot of rock bands and cover bands and things like that. But his full-time career, he was a sales manager in the radio business. And he did that, you know, and supported his family and kind of gave up drums for a while. What didn't really have it in his life. And then I think as his kids got older, me and my sister, he was able to get that back into his life. So, you know, we had a drum set set up, as I was growing up, and he kind of taught me some of my first beats and things like that. And now he's in a really successful, 60s tribute band. Oh. Down in South Florida called Orange Sunshine. And, I've seen that you like tag, you know, all of the things that we talk about in the podcast. I've seen this on other episodes. So, you know, I gotta say, tag my dad's band, Orange Sunshine, in the South Florida area. They don't do as many gigs now. They've actually been a band for, I think, about 12 years. So they've gone through many iterations. They've had some different members and things like that, but they're awesome. And in the bottom half of the state of Florida. They've played a lot of, you know, outdoor festivals, you know, retirement homes. They even played a nudist colony once. So yeah, they're awesome. And some of my extended family definitely has some arts. My great uncle, who actually just passed away a couple weeks ago, he was much older and kind of ready to go. But man, one of the coolest people ever. And he was a concert pianist and a piano tuner. So he actually did make his living, in the arts. And his daughter was a dancer for a long time. And I think she was a dance major. So yeah, there's definitely some music and arts in the family, and lots of teachers, but not necessarily music teachers. I have lots of elementary teachers, special education teachers, things like that. PE teachers. Yeah.
So when you say your dad's a 60s cover band, what 60s genres is he covering?
My dad is a huge Beatles fan.
Okay.
So they definitely do quite a bit of Beatles.
Like mostly early Beatles, or do they get into the weird stuff?
They get into the weird stuff.
Okay, cool.
They actually do it really well. Mm. Like they do A Day in the Life. I mean, nice. The whole shebang with, yeah, you know, all orchestrated out, and they have 4-part harmony. And they do Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And then of course they do a couple other early tunes. And they also do, let's see, I've seen them play multiple times. Kind of a lot of like 60s rock.
Okay.
Yeah. Not only British Invasion, but you know, some other American groups as well. And yeah, they do it really uncommonly well. So especially with the, you know, the 4-part harmony and all that, that's,
so they have to do Beach Boys then, right?
They do some Beach Boys. Sweet. Yep. They do some Beach Boys. I'm trying to think if I've seen them play recently and do any Beach Boys tunes. I can't remember the exact ones that they're doing. They don't have like a theremin out for Good Vibrations, but.
Oh, okay. Well, I was thinking of like, if they harmonize well, then maybe they're doing like Surfer Girl or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure. But they do, playlists based on a single year of the 60s. So they'll do like all 1965, and they have entire playlists of just that year. So that's kind of how they divide it up. It's really neat.
Neat. So maybe like Dave Clark 5 or something like that might be in there too.
Yeah, I think so. Yep. I think so. Magic Spoonful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
early Stones maybe.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Shoot, that might even be.
Cream.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, that might even be early enough for The Who, too. Huh. I can't explain or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they do any Who, but but yeah, definitely The Stones for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. So is it through him that you get into percussion, or is it elsewhere?
Well, it's sort of through him.
Okay.
So he had a drum set set up, like I said, in the house, and we had kind of a practice room. And in sixth grade, he like sat me down behind the drum set and just taught me a very basic like eighth note rock beat, you know, eights on the hi-hat, 1 and 3 on the bass, 2 and 4 on the snare. But in seventh grade, I joined band, and it was a middle school program that was pretty well known at the time in South Florida, and they actually had a marching band. And for me, that was it. Once I saw marching snare drum, I was sold. And that's really what happened. Is I actually joined the band as an alto saxophone player. And about a month in, we were rehearsing some of the marching band music indoors in the band room. And I literally was like rubbernecking, like turning around and watching the snare part.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's what I want to do. And I begged my band director to let me switch. And he said, no, because everyone wants to be on drums their first year. So you got to put in a year on saxophone. And then if you still want to do drums, then you can do it. And I just like got so annoying that he ended up letting me switch in the first year. And then I never went back.
Was any, do you think any of that was like a, because you're a girl like thing that came up, or was it, you think it was just you were playing the other instrument?
I actually kind of wanted to play alto saxophone right off the bat. And okay. I'm not sure why. And then I think with my band director, I think he really did have a policy, you know, not letting people go to drums their first year. And I don't think it had anything to do with like a sort of, you know, female, male, you know, traditional role, you know, oh, well, guys play trumpet and girls play flute. And that's how it was actually, he had a, I mean, I had a great experience with, most of the band directors that I've worked with and even most of the drumline instructors. I never really, felt different as the, you know, the female in the drumline, which was really lucky. And I do know some people that did not have that same experience. But for me, I think it just had more to do with his policy of, you know, we're not going to let people go on drums right away because then we'd have 55 drummers in the room and two clarinetists or whatever, you know? So, and then, yeah, I mean, he was totally supportive at the time when I did switch. And even the guys on the drumline throughout the years, I've been one of the only females in drumline in a lot of the drumlines that I can remember. And I think I just got lucky in being in drumline with people that didn't make a big deal of it either way. You know, I felt really welcome. I never felt like I dealt with any discrimination, but I have female friends that did not have that same experience. So I definitely am aware that it happens. And I think I just happened to be lucky. I also think South Florida is a really diverse area. Whether you're talking about, you know, diversity of sexes within, you know, the band, diversity of races, diversity of cultures, you know, backgrounds, all of that. And so I think it was a kind of a good place to be. I mean, we, you know, my school was such a big mix of Black, white, Hispanic, multiple different languages. You know, you heard Spanish as often as you heard English in that area. And so maybe it was just a place where that diversity was already being more fostered, I guess. And it kind of also went into, you know, female, male, or non-binary, or, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of also lent itself to that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. You glom onto the snare stuff. Is your activities primarily through band and kind of like marching stuff, or are you already doing drum set, or are you getting into all the other percussion that's available?
Yeah, at this time when I was in seventh grade, I was a percussionist in band. But I was really playing a lot more of the non-pitched percussion. Mm-hmm. So our high school band, as we got up through, you know, middle school and everything, our high school band was super competitive. I went to Stoneman Douglas High School, which of course everyone knows now from a shooting, which is very unfortunate. But that was where I grew up, about 2 miles from Stoneman Douglas. And their marching program is extremely competitive, you know, state competitions, kind of competing with a lot of the BOA level bands. So because we were so competitive, I'm not sure that we got placed where exactly it would be best for us, like educationally, but where it would be best for the sound of the band.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I was sort of uninterested in mallets at this time completely. I was just all about snare, all about drum set, all about, you know, non-pitched percussion, toms, multi-setup, whatever it was. But I didn't want to really have much to do with the marimba or bells or xylophone at this point at all.
Well, and there doesn't sound like there was much incentive in the program for that to happen either.
No, you know, I think one time our band director at the time kind of switched us around and said like, okay, Melinda, you're going to play, you know, chimes or whatever. And, you know, this other person who usually plays chimes, you're going to go on snare. And then as it got closer to, you know, FMBC or solo and ensemble, it was like, all right, Melinda, go back on snare. Okay. You go back on chimes, you go on xylophone. We got to get straight ones, you know? So, you know, that was just the nature of that super competitive program. And I really try and have my students get a really well-rounded experience. You know, even within the studio, you know, there if they're an undergrad, they're getting a little bit of each percussion instrument as far as the core instruments go in their lessons. Like, if you want to focus on marimba, you can do that in your master's degree or your doctorate degree. But here, you're going to learn a little bit of everything and get to a certain point on everything, just because I think that really serves them better in their future career.
You alluded to this earlier. So you were saying that as you were going up through your life and you were doing all these music activities, that your parents were also kind of pushing you towards a whole slew of other things. Like you mentioned skiing, ice skating. You mentioned probably a few other things. I can't remember. Those are the two that kind of stuck out, but how were those part of your life?
I know a lot of musicians and percussionists especially who say something like, man, I just did percussion because I wasn't good at anything else. Like I couldn't do anything else. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've had probably somebody come on your podcast and say that. And I think that's kind of a common thing for some reason, you know, for percussionists to say. And that just wasn't me. I always had a lot of other interests. I was in choir. I still love to sing. I was in a cover band actually when I was going through my doctorate, and I was a singer, not the drummer.
What was the cover band of what?
We did wedding band kind of stuff. Party band, wedding band kind of stuff. It was so much fun. The band doesn't exist anymore. Everyone's moved on at this point, but 2016 to 2017, right before I got the job at Graceland, that was one of my gigs as I was kind of applying for other jobs. Yeah, it was some of the most fun I've ever had.
What was your wheelhouse song or songs?
So we did Superstition by Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Into Rapper's Delight. Into Bruno Mars. What was his super famous?
Uptown Funk.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was our like famous like string of songs that we would do on every single gig. And I mean, that's the one that like really got the crowd going, and somewhere in the depths of YouTube, you can find a video of it.
So, and you know all the lyrics to Rapper's Delight?
That was actually the other singer. So we had two singers, a female and a male. Both of us were percussionists in the Indiana University program. He was an undergrad and I was a doctoral student, and both of us would do Brazilian and Afro-Cuban ensemble, which have a huge singing component.
Yeah.
But we kind of realized like, hey, we both really like singing and we can both harmonize really well too. So let's do this other thing. And that's kind of how it got started between me and this other percussionist. His name is Cole. And actually randomly he lives in Colorado now. And he does a lot of Afro-Cuban gigs just south of Denver in that area. And just, he has a killer voice. And so that's kind of how it started. And yeah, we played a couple weddings. We played lots of parties in downtown Bloomington, fraternity parties. Yeah, you name it.
But that was doctorate. So like, but what were the, so you were, you had, so you did choir, but like you also had these other
athletic
pursuits that were going on.
So it was interesting because I was ice skating all the way up through high school. And in high school, I kind of had to make a choice because marching band became all encompassing. And I had to decide, like, do I want to keep doing the competitive ice skating thing or do I want to do music? And at that time, I decided music. And actually what tipped me off that was the right decision for me was in ice skating, you perform to music, right? And usually your coach just picks the music and the ice skater usually doesn't really care what it is. But I cared so much. I was actually suggesting things to her for me to, you know, I'd be like, oh, there's this really cool Danny Elfman soundtrack. So I want to do like this track 3 and then like splice it right here and go into like track 5. And I just realized like I am more passionate about the music side of this than I am even about the ice skating side. And so that's kind of when I realized, okay, I'm going to kind of go into music full time. But exercise is a big part of my life. I'm a Zumba instructor, actually, which Zumba does have a big music component. Oh, yeah. Because you're dancing to, you know, mostly Latin music, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of different styles.
Yeah.
And so I got certified to teach Zumba, and I was always attending gym classes as I was going to school. For me, that was huge for mental health. I mean, during my undergrad, master's, and doctorate, I was at the gym at least maybe 3 to 4 times a week doing something, whether it was a hip hop dance class, just getting on a treadmill for 20 minutes, you know, doing an exercise bike, taking a group yoga class, doing a meditation class. Like, it was just huge for me, for mental health. So I just made time for it. And I know, you know, some people would spend 12 hours in a practice room straight. And for me, if I spent 12 hours in a practice room, I wouldn't get anything done. But if I spent 3 hours in a practice room and then spent an hour at the gym, that for me was better because I was so much more clear mentally with the exercise incorporated as well. So yeah, you know, I just made time for it. And I really allow my students and encourage my students to make time for it as well. So I actually have a couple students here at Adams State that attend my virtual Zumba class every Sunday. And, you know, it's just a really big and important part of my life. And when my students say like, hey, Leosi, you know, I didn't get quite as much done because I went to my counseling appointment or I went to the gym. For me, like that is as important as schoolwork. Like you have to take care of your brain. So you have to take care of your health, you know, mentally and physically. So do that and just make sure that you have a balance. So we talk a lot about like efficient practice strategies. How can you get done in 1 hour what you might get done in 3 if you have all these distractions or if you're really not planning it well, so that they can incorporate other things into their life as well.
Now getting back to the ice skating though, how far along were you as an ice skater?
You know, everyone knows the name of the jumps from watching figure skating.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Sow cow, triple sow cow, this, that, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I was doing double jumps when I finished. And you know,
you mean double spin or combination jumps?
Yeah, like a double spin in the air.
Okay, yeah.
So I was working on a double sow cow and a double loop jump when I stopped. And I was working on a single axel. So axels are, of course, you hear quadruple axel, triple axel, like in the Olympics, all that stuff. An axel is really hard because it has a half extra turn. So in other words, a triple axel is 3.5 turns. You start forwards, but you end backwards.
Yeah,
and it's that extra half a turn that makes it the jump that you kind of really try to achieve before you get to the next one.
So
you learn all the single jumps and then you work on your single axle, which is a turn and a half.
Yeah.
And that's the transition to your double jumps because then you're working on 2 turns. Then you do your double axle, which is 2.5 before you get to your triples. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was at that trying to get consistent on a single axle and then learning some double jumps. And actually, weirdly for me, the double jumps were easier for me than the single axle. That was just, the axle was like the thing that just, it broke me down. I kind of got to that point and I couldn't go further. And I have a lot of friends who went much further and did, you know, all these regional and national competitions and, you know, we're up in that triple jump kind of zone. And, and so I didn't quite get there, but I was doing some cool stuff.
Well, the interesting thing from the outside on in terms of the jumps is that, you know, if you're a basketball fan or not, but like there's like the 1 foot leaper, 2 foot leaper, and the axles are the ones that are more like someone going in for a layup. Cause it's like the other leg comes up to kind of like propel you in the air.
Right.
So it's always it's weird because that always seemed in my head, that seems like it's the easier thing, but it's not because of, like you're saying, because of the extra rotation.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so if anybody's watching ice skating and, you know, they're watching an axle, you'll notice that they go into it forwards and then land backwards, and that's why it's the extra half a turn. So
yeah. How are you on the spinning, like the typical spinning elements?
I was a strong jumper, and spins were harder for me. So what you're looking for in a spin is when you look at the ice, there should be a perfect circle. And you're not supposed to do very much of what they call traveling.
Yeah.
So the circle goes out.
Right.
And you can actually see that. Your coach will come up and look and say, ah, oh, you traveled a lot on this camel spin or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Or, oh, this sit spin, you know, you really started to travel or you weren't rotating fast enough or whatever. So I was always stronger at the jumps, the sort of athletic side of it, than the choreography and like the sort of the dance element and the ballet to it. You know, a lot of ice skaters will take ballet classes. Yeah. As they start to get more competitive, just to get that artistry side of it, you know, up to where the athleticism was. And for me, yeah, I was very strong at jumping, but I didn't quite have that dance background to do like the really high level choreography. And spins, yeah, it depends on what spin it was. You know, a camel spin is where your foot is straight back behind you.
Yeah.
And that one I was pretty good at. The sit spin, of course, that's exactly what it sounds like when you kind of sit down on one foot and put your other foot out.
Right.
But I couldn't do a layback spin yet. That's the one that I was working on when I kind of finished, which is, of course, where they gracefully lay back and they have their arms up and everything. Right. So that's kind of where I was, yeah.
Is the one thing that I always love and I always get mad when I don't see the solo performers do it, is the one that goes really fast when they do like the, it's where they're kind of like vertical and then they go, it's like boom, boom, vroom, like really fast. And they spin slower out. I always love that one.
Yeah. That's called a scratch spin.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, so you put your leg out for a scratch spin. And then when you pull it in, that's when you start to go faster.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people that are really good at that spin, like they'll pull it in and they'll just that's where you see that really like that increase in speed. It's kind of like the big finale kind of spin. You can do combinations and then put that at the end and just make the crowd go wild.
it's pretty awesome. Who's your favorite figure skater?
So when I was growing up, you know, this is kind of a different era. I do follow some of the figure skaters today, but I think when I was growing up, you know, I loved Nancy Kerrigan. I loved Christy Yamaguchi.
Yeah.
Oksana Bayul was like just coming on the scene kind of when, you know, when I was figure skating, and she was just like taking the world by storm. I really liked Scott Hamilton because he was always like funny. I liked watching his routines. And of course, he could do the flip also. He was one of the skaters at the time that could do like a front and a back flip.
Yeah.
So that was really cool too.
Yeah, those are good. I didn't know. The one name who tends to come up a lot is Michelle Kwan.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. She was a little later.
Yeah.
For me, like kind of the next generation, and Tara Lipinski too.
Right,
You know, I just as I was kind of getting out of it, she was kind of bursting onto the scene, and then you know, there's some others now that I kind of just follow on Instagram and.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The most recent one that I was, might've been my favorite was Yuna Kim.
Oh, I see. I haven't even heard of that.
Oh, okay. I think she's South Korean.
We will continue with more with Melinda Leosi and the rest of the story next week, so stay tuned. This week's rave is the 2021 limited series Genius Aretha, starring Cynthia Erivo in the title role of Aretha Franklin and written by Susan Laurie Parks and currently streaming on Hulu. I've long been a fan of Aretha Franklin. Safe to say most folks are, I think. And a series like this is always concerning for me. I'd much rather watch a long documentary on an artist versus a dramatic interpretation of one's life. That said, I think this show turned out well for a number of reasons. The primary of these is the casting of Cynthia Erivo as Aretha Franklin. In my opinion, no singer alive is going to be able to capture the full spirit of Aretha as singer and performer, predominantly because that person would have to be both the greatest pop singer and the greatest piano player combined. That's really tough to do. But if you're going to get someone to just take care of the singing as well as make her look pretty close to Miss Franklin, then Cynthia Erivo is your best bet. There are plenty of great singers out there who will be or are involved in other Aretha Franklin projects. But Cynthia Erivo is the best out there right now, precisely because she has the vocal technique to both sing as herself and imitate, really, anyone. This became clear when she was interviewed by Trevor Noah on the Daily Social Distancing show, and in the midst of describing a part of Aretha's process, broke right into a perfect comparison rendition of Elton John's Border Song and Aretha's version of the same, and then just starts back into the conversation. And Trevor Noah's response to this is essentially, so I'm just supposed to act like what you just did was no big deal. And you know what? Maybe to Cynthia Erivo, it's not a big deal. But to everyone else, it's mind-blowing. As an aside, in preparation for this series, I've also been reading David Ritz's biography on Aretha Franklin to get some more background on her life, which has been insightful, interesting, and also really heartbreaking. While the series takes us through much of Aretha's professional life, particularly in her prime years from the late 60s into the early to mid 70s, it also uses a lot of flashback throughout to showcase related events in her younger days that were impactful to her later life. The show concludes, unsurprisingly, with her well-known replacement performance for Pavarotti at the last minute of the opera aria Nessun Dorma at the 1998 Grammys. This is presented correctly, also, because Erivo begins it, and then the actual performance of Aretha at the helm is fleshed out to conclude the series. Another aspect that is really well done is the music, because not only does Erivo shine in her abilities to reproduce Aretha's vocals, but there are also all of the period sounds and styles are recreated and maintained very well throughout. One last note. As explained in the biography and by those who knew her best, Aretha was, for many, many reasons, an emotionally closed-off person. She was not someone who wanted to spend any time reminiscing or dwelling on the past, particularly as it regarded the many personal traumas that she faced throughout her life. She was always forward-looking. In knowing that, a limited series that allows for some dramatic license can also actually be more effective at portraying someone's inner life. For all of those reasons and more, check out Genius Aretha, streaming on Hulu. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next week for part 2 with Melinda. Until then.